Good, okay. About the gifts, I just have so much been blessed by the teachings that Renee and Kevin Oliver have been doing on the book of Genesis. And last week, Kevin reminded us that God is the main character in the Bible, the faithful God. And many times we get chances to renew and kind of think we've got a blank slate. But even when we have a blank slate, it's not really a blank slate, because God's kind of always out in front of us and already has things that are happening before we even know it. But sometimes it seems like a blank canvas to us. Never really is. 2 weeks ago, Renee talked about how, nevertheless, although God takes great risks in involving us in this art project, this great project of creation that God has, and I do think it's a great risk for God to involve me or you or anyone else, and that God wants us to learn to risk being faithful. And sometimes, as Renee talked about, that means going forth, taking risks that feel like we're risking everything that's safe, and putting that on the line. So that's the last couple of teachings. Today I'd like to have us lose a couple of common misperceptions. The first one that I just find so prevalent, I hear it as we talk sometimes, I hear it on the radio and TV and in the papers and everywhere from believers, is, you know, if I could just hear God, then everything would be easy and clear, and I'd know how to make my decisions and live my life. Or if I'm doing God's will, then isn't life supposed to be easy? And I expect it to be.
You mean that's not true?
That's a fact.
Wait a minute.
That's a fact, right? Or if I could just see that God was doing some things, then I wouldn't have any doubts, I wouldn't have any questions, I wouldn't feel like God's promises are threatened. And yes, they're not true. They are not true. The second one is, if I can't figure out what God's doing, then God isn't doing anything. I think many of us have that inside us, even if we don't acknowledge it to ourselves or to others. If I can't see God at work, then nothing's happening. The truth is, often most of what God's doing is behind the scenes for me to see, and I don't really figure it out very well. So those two misconceptions I would like to just trace through our text of Genesis for a while. I cheated a bit. Renee assigned me chapters 13, 14, and I went backwards, and I went forwards, and I even went to another book. Don and I were doing a devotional time and read from Ecclesiastes, and I had this thought, wonder if Abram ever felt like this. Now, this guy was a real cynic, so Caroline's reading for me today.
What do we gain from all our work? I know the heavy burdens that God has laid on us. He's set the right time for everything. God has given us a desire to know the future, but God never gives us the satisfaction of fully understanding what God is doing.
So God created us so that we want to know what's happening, and then let the world be such that I rarely do. That's pretty cynical, right? All God's fault. So I read 13, 14, even went back 11, 12, and then I realized I had to cheat and read ahead a little bit. And I think Abraham says almost the same thing. Caroline?
After this, Abram had a vision and heard the Lord say to him, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I will shield you from danger and give you a great reward." But Abram answered, "Sovereign Lord, what good will your reward do me? I have no children. My only heir is Eliezer of Damascus. You've given me no children, and one of my slaves will inherit my property."
I'll mention again later, but this happens about 10 years after those great promises in Genesis 12, according to Genesis 16:3. And Abraham basically says to God, "What reward? Yeah, I mean, you've done some things, but life's a mess. What really matters to me isn't happening. What reward?" 10 years have gone by. Quite a few more are going to go by. So let's look back and see kind of how we got here. And what I want to talk about is one way to read Genesis 11 through 15, and really the rest of Genesis, is that life seems to constantly threaten God's promises. So let's remember what the promise is. Caroline?
Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
Now, as I said, there's just no way to read Genesis as though I'd never read it before. I doubt that there is for you either. But I wish I could read it once that way because it's so fascinating. So if you cheat a little, go back. We've already been given a hint that there are going to be threats to this promise. Chapter 11 says, but Sarah was barren. Now that's a little bit of a threat to, I'm going to make a great nation of you, right? And 10 years go by. And if you read the rest of Genesis, 25 years go by. And it becomes a big threat. And they make some mistakes along the way trying to figure out how this could work. But it's not the only threat. God says, I want you to go to a land. I'm going to show you. I'm going to give you. And then the writer kind of sticks in without any comment. Now, there are Canaanites in the land. Well, that only happens to be a powerful culture that is not going to welcome anybody who thinks it's their land that they're about to get. And then just to be sure we didn't miss it, the writer comes in chapter 13 and says again, there are Canaanites and Perizzites in the land. Big, powerful culture and some other culture we don't know much about. Another threat to God's promise. If I was Abraham, I might have said, you want to show me another land? Right? One where all these people don't already live and think they own it? But that's only part of it. The next one is, it's a land I'll give you, and I'm going to really bless you. And the next phrase in the Genesis is, and there was a famine in the land. And it was so bad, he had to run to Egypt. Now, that's a threat to the land. That's a threat to being blessed. At least I would consider being hungry a threat to being blessed. I suspect you would. And the threat is of Egyptian power. Let's listen as Caroline reads.
But there is a famine in Canaan, and it was so bad that Abram went further south to Egypt to live there for a while. When he was about to cross the border into Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, you're a beautiful woman. When the Egyptians see you, they'll assume that you're my wife, and so they will kill me and let you live. Please tell them that you are my sister. Then, because of you, they will let me live and treat me well.
You know, apparently the world hadn't changed much since back in Genesis 6 when the powerful people were just going out and taking any woman they wanted that was beautiful. Abram's still afraid that's what's going to happen. We find out Sarah's a beautiful woman at this point. And, you know, most people don't think beauty's a threat, but it can be. I've seen it be a threat in quite a number of people's lives, to be honest. Wealth can be a threat. Our educations can be a threat. All these nice gifts that God gives us at some times become a threat. And in this case, the great Egyptian power, Abram really thinks it may cost him his life. That wasn't an idle threat. It happens all over the world still. Powerful warlords go in, kill the men, kill the sons, take the girls, take the women, make them their harems, make them their sex slaves. Still happening everywhere. He wasn't at all wrong about that. And I would like to say in Abram's favor, I don't know why the translations don't do this, but there's a little Hebrew word, nah. It can be translated several ways, but the most, usually the way it's translated is please, or I beg you, or I pray of you. And they kind of leave it out here, and they also leave it out in Genesis 22 when God asked Abram to sacrifice Isaac. Really, God says, please. Abram says to Sarah, please. So if you're in English, you know how we have imperatives that aren't imperatives? If I say, Bob, please do this. Now, the do this is an imperative, except when the please is there, I'm begging, right, with a lot of passion. Abraham says, please do this. And one more, to be fair, the threat is not just to him. How would you like all of you women, all you who are married and wives, single or married, to be taken to a foreign country, made a slave for somebody, and left there the rest of your life? So both of them, tremendous threat. They don't know what to do. They figure out the best they know. As Kevin reminded us last week, the Genesis writer doesn't even say anything about whether they made a good choice or a bad choice. just says God was still there. It had to be an incredible threat to the promise. His life, his wife. Now the next threat to this promise of in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. I want you to shift gears for a minute. Put yourself in the mindset of Pharaoh, the Egyptian powerful person, and you tell me if you think that all the people of the world are being blessed. Listen as we read.
But because the king had taken Sarai, the Lord sent terrible diseases on him and on the people of his palace. Then the king sent for Abram and asked him, "What have you done to me? Why didn't you tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say that she was your sister and let me take her as my wife? Here's your wife. Take her and get out." The king gave orders to his men, so they took Abram and put him out of the country, together with his wife and everything he owned.
Now, I guess the Pharaoh was blessed in that he didn't die, and he was about to. But he didn't feel very blessed, right? I mean, listen to this. He says, "You lied to me. I'm sick. I'm dying. Get the hell out of here, man." And that's what he does. He just tells him, get out. He can't stand him anymore, and drives him out. You know, Abraham must have thought, blessing to all nations? Seems a little strange. Next, in Genesis 13, the entire chapter is about a family feud. I hope none of you have had to live through those, but they're pretty common in the world. And about a relative's greed, and that's more common than we wish as well. Let's listen.
So quarrels.
Actually, yeah, let me just mention it again. In the light of, you'll be a blessing, and you'll be blessed. Go ahead, Caroline.
So quarrels broke out between the men who took care of Abram's animals and those who took care of Lot's animals. Then Abram said to Lot, "So please."
Well, there's another one of those pleases that's often left out, but go ahead.
"So please, let's separate. Choose any part of the land you want." Lot looked around and saw that the whole Jordan Valley had plenty of water, like the Garden of God. So Lot chose the whole Jordan Valley for himself.
Okay, so this time their wealth and their success is threatening them. They've gotten so much animals, people, land, not land they own, but land they're using for grazing. Their people start fussing and fighting with each other. Now, I want to, you know, we Americans just aren't like this very much. Some families are, but many of us aren't. In the Middle East, and still today, but in the Middle East, there's an etiquette that everybody knows. Powerful people and those subject to them, people who have things and people who work for them and don't have as much, people who are the older generation and people who are the younger generation. Now, Lot fits in the downside of all of those, and Abram fits in the upside of all of those. So when Abram says, you know, this is Abram who has been taking care of Lot for quite a few years, right? Letting him travel with him, letting him become wealthy. When Abram says, the land just can't handle us both, we need to separate, please let's separate, what do you suspect Lot's supposed to say back? Abram says, you can choose, that's nice, that's hospitable, that's the right kind of thing to say. And Lot's supposed to say, no way. Well, you're the one. You're the one who's brought me with you. You're the one who's made me wealthy. You're my uncle. No way. You choose. Lot says, yeah, I want that one. Right? Must have felt like another threat to the promises that God was going to bless Abram, take care of him, bless those who bless him. Didn't feel good. Threat number 7. Through you, I will bless all nations. Let's listen to what actually happens, and then I'll explain a little bit of it.
The four kings took everything in Sodom and Gomorrah, including the food, and went away. Lot, Abram's nephew, was living in Sodom, so they took him and all his possessions.
There, go ahead and read the next one, too, if you would.
Yep. There, Abram divided his men into groups, attacked the enemy by night, and defeated them. And Abram got back all the loot that had been taken. He also brought back his nephew Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other prisoners.
Okay, this I bless all nations. Apparently the setting, as it's described in Genesis, is that some tribal chiefdoms have become very powerful. They've conquered and subdued a great portion of the land around what we today call Israel, Jordan, Palestine, all those areas, a little more maybe. And the other people who have been subdued decide to rebel. And they get together another alliance. And for those of you who are Tolkien fans, it's where Tolkien got the line, this many kings against this many kings, four kings against five, the writer of Genesis says, except the four kings demolish them. And Lot gets caught up in this, and he is taken captive, and everything he's got is taken, and Sodom, all their wealth is taken, which were the rules of warfare in the ancient world. Not that different today, but a little bit different perhaps. So Abram, we find out, has over 300 young men that he's trained, and they're pretty good, but he shouldn't win this war. He plans a surprise ambush. They go in at night. They defeat this big, strong alliance that's been running this part of the world for quite a while. And, you know, I just, if you were to ask those four kings, is Abraham a blessing to all nations? I suspect they would say, not my country and not my people. The others might feel a little differently, so it's kind of a mixed bag. And, you know, Abram didn't really have any reason he even needed to do this, except in spite of the way Lot's treated him, he still feels responsible to his nephew, so he gets involved and goes to war. War's always a risk, and certainly a risk to your blessings and your life. I would say sometimes, though, our successes are our biggest risks and threats to God's promises in our life. That's been true for me at times in my life. I used to laugh. You know, days when I was going to get up and teach, and I was really feeling uneasy, and I didn't think I had a very good teaching, and it wasn't together. And then somehow it came together, and it all went well, and everybody was saying, oh, that was really a blessing. I was really challenged. And I was thinking, boy, I did a good job. Forgot that an hour ago I didn't know if I could even talk. Well, Abram wins an incredible war. It would be very tempting for him to start grasping at those promises of taking that land and keeping all that money and property and become another warlord of that part of the country. He would have probably been a very successful one, actually. He does something extremely different. Instead of saying, look at what I did, Abram worships and thanks God, finds a righteous priest king, we call Melchizedek, his name means king of righteousness, who's the king of the town of Salem, and gives a tenth of all that he's got in honor to God, a tithe of all that he has, to say thank you for his life, for his nephew, for the being alive and still having all these promises. And the king of Sodom comes to him and says, I know you've got the right to keep all the properties and everything, but at least give me my people. Abraham actually had a right to keep the people. That was the rules of ancient warfare. Abraham says, don't want any of it. Take it all. I don't ever want you to be able to say you're the one who made me successful. We'll leave it to God. Take everything that's yours and go. I would say that might have been one of the bigger temptations, actually, to just grab it and say, oh, God bless me, now I can just take this land. It's mine. He doesn't do it that way. And now we're all the way back to where we started. Let's read it again. I will make of you a great nation. Abram, the threat is doubts, questions, confusion, because there's no heir after 10 long years. Would you read, Caroline?
After this, Abram had a vision and heard the Lord say to him, do not be afraid, Abram. I will shield you from danger and give you a great reward. But Abram answered, Sovereign Lord, what good will your reward do me? I have no children. My only heir is Eliezer of Damascus. You've given me no children, and one of my slaves will inherit my property.
I don't know about you, but I have my share of doubts and questions and frustrations and confusions about God and life and what's going on and what's God doing and what am I supposed to do? And Abram's in that place. He's rather cynical about it, actually. He says, what reward? Yeah, I got all this stuff, but I'm going to die and it's going to go to somebody else, whoever takes it next. Or I can give it to my steward, my slave. So what's God's response going to be? What's God's response to your questions and confusions and times when you're really frustrated and don't know what to make of God or anything else? It's a good question. Well, let's listen. The first thing that God does is God adds some more details to the promise. Caroline?
A son will come from your own body. The Lord took him outside and said, look at the sky and try to count the stars. You will have as many descendants as that.
Now, Abram may have assumed always that it was going to be a child from his own body, but he had quit assuming that. He started thinking it was going to be a slave. God says, no, it'll be a child from your body. Now, he hasn't said Sarah yet, which will come into the play later. And he adds, look up the stars, nice night stars in the Middle East. Count them up if you can. Your descendants will be more than you can see up there. They are today, even. More than we can see. No fair using the telescope. The second part of God's response, equally surprising perhaps, given that he's talking to somebody who just insulted God and said, what reward? And who's filled with confusions and frustrations. Let's listen.
Abram put his trust in the Lord, and because of this, the Lord was pleased with him and counted him righteous.
That sentence became so important that it's the key sentence of the entire book of Romans that Paul wrote. That God took this frustrated, confused person, but a person who had risked so much faith and faithfulness, and said to him, your faithfulness, such as it is very pleasing to me, and I count it as righteousness. You're a righteous man. You did catch what we just went through, didn't you? God risked a lot in being involved with us, and it goes up and down, and we risk a lot in being involved with God. But God's response is very gentle and faithful here. He says, I want you to understand, I do see that you're trying, and I count it as righteousness, and I'm pleased with you. And then the final response that we have in Genesis 13 is God says, I want you to understand, I'm taking this really seriously. And so in this vision that is there, and I mentioned the last time I taught, they take some animals, they cut them in half, and you know, everybody expects Abraham at the end of this vision to walk through and say, I swear my life to God, my whole life, everything, so help me God, or I die. Instead, the smoke and the fire that represents God goes through the cutting of the covenant. And God's response to all these ups and downs and confusions and frustrations of a man who is trying to be faithful, God's response is, I'll up the ante. I will swear an oath on my own life that I am going to keep this covenant with you. Trust me. If you've been cheating and reading ahead, it doesn't get any easier. But this made a difference. It was a new, one of those, what Kevin talked about last week, a renewed blank slate that wasn't really a blank slate as the artwork goes forward. So, two major takeaways I hope for you. One of them is a faith journey with God is going to be ups and downs. Don't kid yourself that if you're seeing God and you're giving your life and you're really willing to even take some risks, that that's going to make it all easy. But what's true is you'll get to make some wonderful choices of trust. You'll also have many times that you make less than wonderful responses. You'll also have times you won't even know later whether you got it right or not. That's part of it. There'll be times when you have doubts and frustrations and confusions, and there'll be opportunities to build altars and say, thank you, God. You ended up being here after all. Thank you. That's one. The other one is that God will be faithful because God's a God of covenant promises. God's vulnerable to you, willing to work in a life like yours and mine. God is willing to be with you when you get it right. God is even going to be with you when you don't know what to do, but you've got to do something. God is going to be with you when you get it wrong, and God's going to be with you when you have doubts and questions. And none of these will threaten God's faithfulness, because God is a God of faithfulness and of covenant. So as we come to communion, when we get to Jesus, God renews that covenant, re-guarantees it, and he re-guarantees it with the very lifeblood of his son. This time he swears it on the blood of his son, not just some animals, and says, I'll be with you. To use Jesus' words, Caroline?
Take, eat, remembering me. Take, drink, remembering me. This is the new covenant guaranteed by my lifeblood for the forgiveness of many. I'll be with you to the end of the age.
So when we go to communion, it's a celebration of a God who keeps covenant, not who makes it easy, but who will be there and who will be there in the end, and who has a project that you get the privilege of being a part of. I wanted to just summarize it in my words. In this renewed covenant, Jesus says, now I'm going to be vulnerable to you. I'll be with you when you get it right. I'll be with you when you don't know what to do, but you've got to do something. I'll be with you when you get it wrong. I'll be with you even when you have doubts and confusions and frustrations and fears. None of these are going to stop God from keeping the promises of this new covenant. When you take the bread, remember me. When you take the wine, remember me. Amen.